It happens very slowly and then all at once. Everything in life is going fine and things are going perfectly normal. However, one day you notice that you are feeling a bit more gray than usual. You can't really pinpoint what exactly is causing it, though. At first, you pay no mind and figure that it's just because work has been a bit busier recently. And, you know, the sun has been setting a lot earlier than usual. You start staying up later and sleeping less, but that's okay because there are plenty of YouTube documentaries and things to read. Plus, you've always wanted more time for your hobbies, so maybe sleeping less isn't all that bad. However, the gray gets grayer. The hobbies, interests, and things you used to love are now stained and gray, and are becoming less interesting with each passing day. In fact, you could pretty much go without them and not miss them. Honestly, even if you wanted to participate in these hobbies, it wouldn't matter, because your attention and energy have been so low and inconsistent recently. It's been tough to focus, tough to make decisions, and tough to concentrate on just about anything. And don't even get me started on how bad my memory is recently. As this new yet familiar gray sets in, you start to feel a bit guilty about what you have become. And then you start feeling guilty about feeling guilty. You feel shameful that you can't snap yourself out of it. And now you are feeling shameful for feeling shameful. It's the worst feedback loop. So what do? You order your favorite takeout, which is obviously Thai papaya panang curry with tofu, medium heat because I'm feeling a little risky. However, you finally get a sense that something must really be up with you because even your favorite food now seems disgusting when right in front of you. Your own body is feeling more foreign day by day. So instead, you think maybe a night with friends would be good. However, you delete the text and close your phone because there's no way anyone would want to hang out with someone as sad as you. That would just bring down the mood. This causes you to do a little self-evaluation. You look around the room and see you haven't folded your clothes in weeks. You find yourself pacifying the gray through trivial things, and you have dedicated 22 hours to Minecraft this week. You sigh gently as your face falls between your hands, and you whisper to yourself sweetly, "Damn it, I think I'm depressed." Again, and thank you for tuning in to the happy and bright podcast that is The Vapor. As always, I appreciate you lending me your ear and your valuable time. If you've not guessed it, today we will be diving into the topic of being really freaking sad. So, depression, or rather, being at our lowest and not knowing where to go from there. I've been going through my own season of beige and gray tones in life, so at times I've been finding myself staring at the ceiling and wondering what it feels like to be gray in other people's lives. I have some questions floating around my head, like, what do my lows feel like compared to the ones you experience in your life? Do we have some of the same rock bottom symptoms? Like, do you ever find yourself tired all day, yet right when it comes time to sleep, you have this rebellious burst of energy that was apparently dormant all day until it was bedtime? Or maybe your stomach will growl all day, but to eat any food sounds nauseating. A different angle, and I do apologize for the advanced terms I'm about to use, but if we freaky Friday'd with one another and swapped bodies, how different would our sadness feel? Or would we just bring our own sadness with us into whatever body we had? More realistically, and probably more helpful, I also wonder things like, how do you notice you're going downhill? And if so, can you correct it? Once, while sitting around a bonfire, someone close to me said they don't see their depression and anxiety as something they can beat because it will always come back. However, each time it comes back, they do have better tools and habits from previous experiences to combat it and recover more quickly. So then tell me, what does it feel like for you to be gray? What tools do you have that help you to combat it? And if you know that feeling all too well, how do you get out once you notice? Well, that's the question we are wrapping our heads around today. Because even though my brain may attempt to spin a tale and tell me I'm the only one feeling this way, and not to write an embarrassingly whole episode about it, I find that statistically unlikely. And maybe you, like myself at times, have this looming conception that you should be able just to snap out of it here soon and everything will fall back into place on its own, right? Well, what about if that doesn't happen? And days or months go by without being able to correct your own course? Well, that's a great question. And I have said before, I do not consider myself to be in the place to answer that for you. But what I can offer is the stories of others and maybe some tools to help us both chip away at that sadness within us. The bottom line is that I'm making this episode because I encourage both of us to take into consideration every resource we have available, even if that resource is a cheeky podcast like this. You're worth the effort and you're worth the time it takes to get happy. So, before we get too far into it all, something I think that is worth drawing a difference between would be the contrast of sadness to depression. Sadness is a natural and most often temporary emotion that we all feel. It comes up in response to events in our lives like loss, disappointment, or hurt. So when the new plant you have purchased withers slowly to nothing, when the series you're reading comes to an end, those feelings are more akin to sadness and not necessarily depression. The good thing about sadness, if I can convince you there's a good thing, is that it usually has a pretty clear cause if you take a moment to dig into it, and typically resolves as the circumstance change or you move past the saddening event. Sadness ebbs and flows throughout our life as a perfectly normal emotion for us to get to know. But sadness within itself is also pretty complex. The first thing I think about in my brain is how there are different sizes to sadness. Like how there's the small sad when you're at the grocery and on the shelf is just an empty void where your favorite brand usually sits. Or when you guess the end of a story and wish you could have just been surprised. And then there's the big sad in the moments like losing a ring that your grandma gave you or having to say goodbye to a family pet. Those moments are still sad, but they carry different weights of sadness if you compare them. Then there are also the moments where sadness is mixed in with other positive emotions and takes on its own complementary role. Like when your best friend is moving away to Japan, and you know it's best for them and it will make them happy, but your heart is also mixed with sadness because you realize the season is changing. I would personally say that sadness is just one word for a real depth of feelings. Mary Ruffel writes about sadness in her poetry, giving all the different sensations of sadness that she feels their own color. Some of the colors that she gives it are blue sadness, which is the sadness of nostalgia. The happiness of a memory that is now only a memory, she writes. Orange sadness that is made of anxiety and worry. This sadness is when one frets another heavy shipment of thoughts appearing at their mental front door. There is also pink sadness that is the sadness of lack or going without something. The sadness of the soles coming off your favorite pair of shoes, she says. There are many more colors that she paints her sadness, but I won't go over them all here. But it does go to show how even though we maybe only use one word, sadness, there are many layers to it that you're bound to meander through as you live. Sadness is somewhat unavoidable, and although it may not always be fun on your first breakup, later in life it can act as a really sweet compass to point you to the things you care most about. Depression, however, is more pervasive and persistent than sadness. Depression changes your behavior and thoughts in a way that impact your daily life. It's a clinical mental health disorder characterized by persistent sadness over a long period of time paired with a range of symptoms like feeling irritable, heavy shame, loss of interest in activities, changes in appetite, loss of sleep, feelings of guilt or worthlessness, and a long list of other mentally draining side effects. It's estimated that 21% of adults between the age of 18 and 24 experience depression. This drops down to about 18% in other age groups. So like I said, it's statistically unlikely that either of us are the only people out here feeling a little crazy at times. The thing about depression is that it can be a bit more complex than sadness, since there may not always be a clear-cut cause to the depression, and it tends to overstay its welcome. I do not think it is a coincidence that the root of the word is also depress, which means to push something down. Now, I'm not sure if they meant that you are the thing being depressed and pushed down, or if they meant that you are pushing something down that needs to be addressed and it's keeping you depressed. I can see either use of the word working pretty well. On top of its list of draining symptoms, it can also be very difficult to express the emotions of depression to those close to you. At times, you can notice it taking new shapes and attaching itself to different areas in your life. One day, you're depressed about your job, but if your work environment settles down a bit, the depression won't go away. It may just find a new source, and now you're shaking your fist at kids on your lawn. In my experience, depression can put you in such a fugue state where you don't really desire anything at all. You don't know what direction is up or down. You'll sort of just wake up one day to realize that each aspect of your life is really only there because it snuck in through the path of least resistance. You don't have the same energy or desire you used to, so you strangely may not really desire to even get better or improve at all. At least for me, depression and apathy often hold hands, and they are a nasty couple. To add to the emotional complexity of it all, studies have also shown that some individuals carry a gene that makes them far more likely to experience sustained despair after a traumatic event compared to the average person. Which means you might just have a predisposition to having an objectively harder time processing certain events, which admittedly feels unfair. So, for comparing them both, sadness is something you may feel heavily, but with some introspection, you can potentially come to realize what is causing it and move past it more quickly. But for depression, it can be debilitating since it can leave you not having any clue what you should do or what you should even hope for to fix, since the source could be situational, chemical, or a mix of both. To speak to how heavy depression can feel when it has you at your lowest and maybe darkest, David Foster Wallace likens it to someone in a burning building who is contemplating jumping from the window. The fear of the fall has not gone away, and the person's not desiring to fall, but rather it is the fear of the flames. When the flames get close enough to the person, falling to death becomes the less terrible outcome of two terrors. And, for a brighter perspective to help us steer clear of those flames, we can look to David Hume, who said that when he was overcome by unbearably dreadful thoughts, he would retire for the evening and play games with his friends. He claimed that when returning to the dreadful thoughts after, he would see them as cold and ridiculous, so much so that he wouldn't even bother with them any longer. Okay, so then, what the heck do I do with all this knowledge in my head about sadness and depression? Well, honestly, I kind of got stuck there for a while, looking for a cohesive answer and trying to find the best way to craft that into a valuable episode. How do I make sense of a topic that makes you feel like you're swimming through molasses? Well, eventually I was reading and attempting to sort out my thoughts or next steps, and I found a quote that I liked by Dr. Anthony Storr. He said, "When a person is encouraged to get in touch with and express his deepest feelings in the secure knowledge that he knows he will not be rejected, criticized, or expected to be different, some kind of rearrangement or sorting out process often occurs within the mind, which brings a sense of peace a sense that the depths of the well of truth have truly been reached. Now, it is a bit of a wordy quote, but reading this quote reminded me of the original goal I set out with. I wanted to hear from others what it was like to be gray for them and how they typically go about getting out. So like Dr. Storr and Dr. Hume said, if I wanted to get closer to the deep well of truth within me and others, then I needed to phone a friend. Someone who would not be caught off guard by any of the things I was saying, but would just join in the moment and share how they traverse their own emotional ups and downs. So, I reached out to my friend Nathan to tell him about the episode and ask if he was interested in coming over for a conversation, and thankfully he accepted. I asked Nathan because it's been well over a decade since we became friends, and we met right as I was turning 18 and moving to Nashville, which means we've been through some difficult and really lovely events together. Nathan is one of the most honest people I know in this life, and I knew there was nothing I could say that would catch him off guard. He's been through enough of the highs and lows of life to have a very realistic perspective that sometimes you do just have to embrace that life sucks, while also creating some pockets of joy where you can. So I wanted to see what tools he brings back to the table each time he sees himself getting gray. When he got here, it was pretty low stakes. We had dinner, and I read him some of my notes on what I had written so far for an episode. Then I clicked record and asked Nathan rather bluntly,
what do you feel like you do when you're sad?
And that is where our conversation started. No real goal or direction, just one question and an interest in where it would take us.
Whenever I think about like what I do and where I'm at is, I'm often, not instead of trying to go and do something, I try to do as little as possible. And it's not like that I'm necessarily trying to do as little as possible. I just don't want to do anything.
Yeah.
So whenever, you know, when you were saying earlier in the intro about your food, the food doesn't taste good and hobbies don't seem as enjoyable, or the line about, you know, you text your friends and why then you delete the text because why would you bother?
Yeah.
That's an emotional space for me to even just hear you say that out loud is like, okay, that's a lot of how I respond in those moments is where it's, you know, I've got a good group of friends that I know that I could reach out to whenever things are hard, but I don't. I often won't. And, you know, that, and like you talk about food not tasting good, like, Whenever I notice that I'm getting depressed or gray or whatever you want to call it, I will typically lose 5, 10, 15 pounds for that period of time because I'm not going to eat. I just don't really feel a sense or a need to even kind of feed myself.
Yeah.
You know, and nothing tastes good. Nothing, like I look at restaurants, I'll look at what's in the pantry and it just is like, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know? We talk about isolating. Whenever I get low, the first thing I do is isolate. It's like I'm watching myself in third person. You know, I can see it happen. I can even see it coming. But I isolate myself, which becomes very self-feeding. You know, because the further I'm isolated, the more I convince myself that I am isolated for a reason. And I wouldn't feel so isolated if I didn't deserve to be isolated.
Rough feedback loop.
It turns into a real feedback loop where it's people aren't reaching out to me because they're trying to give me space to deal with, overcome, what have you. And I'm certainly not reaching out to anyone because for a few things. First of all, I don't want to be a burden to anyone. It's sort of baked into me. I don't want to feel like people are having to carry me across some finish line. But also I get to a place where I don't feel like they would care. And that's the brutal, hard way of saying the true thing that I'm thinking in those moments is, if I get down these rabbit holes of if people actually cared, then someone would notice.
Yeah.
And since no one has noticed, whether they have or not, then they don't care.
Yeah.
And so it's better if I just stay over here in this corner. And it's, for me, it's super easy to dive into work and get, you know, shoulder deep into whatever task I've got going on at my job. I have a demanding job, but it's not overly demanding, but I can make it overly demanding if I choose.
That's a great way to put it.
And I, you know, I can dive into that because of all the things that I am, I know kind of objectively that I'm pretty good at my job. And I'm not going to have all the answers all the time, but I know that I can find confidence and success there. And so I know that if I'm having a hard time connecting with my community, or if I'm having a hard time connecting with my family, my kids, my wife, etc., then I'm probably going to find myself up to my waist in work, because I know that I can be there confidently.
Yeah.
And can find that, I guess, kind of self-satisfaction. My therapist and I have talked about this at great length.
For other people's sake.
Yeah, just on behalf of, you know, friends, not for me. But, you know, we talk about how, you know, you get into these spots where you do start kind of this loop of not feeling worthy of existing and all of these things. And so, I turn down invitations. Like, people invite me out, and I'll find myself busy, you know, and I'll, you know, people will be reaching out, and I'll put a hand up and put a stop to it. And that just is just further damaging. But what I have found, though, is that every single time, almost without fail, that I get outside my own head long enough to accept the invitation, or not even the invitation, but if I just go out and do the thing that I'm over here telling myself I can't or shouldn't or won't do, then inevitably I come back and I feel 10 times better.
Yeah.
Every time. Like, this is not revolutionary. This is what therapists and counselors have been telling people for 1,500 years.
Yes.
You know, but I'm over here feeling like a genius because I discovered it at 46.
Yeah. I'm over here feeling like you're a sage because I can hear it.
Yeah, I'm so wise.
Yeah, and I love that of, like, it is silly to feel like the simple things really do work.
I have been doing this now for 40 some odd years.
Yeah.
And it just feels like, to me, it feels like the only thing that really heals that is time. Mm. There have been times where I have been in long, long periods of very dark darkness. And people around me are screaming at me to wake up, to come back, whatever it may be. And I just don't have the strength or the desire to make that happen. And what ends up changing often is really nothing all that tangible. It's just, I don't know, it's just this, it's like almost like my soul almost needed to feel this for a season so that it could come back again.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a very odd place to think about, because I don't really have any ways to pull myself out.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel myself chanting like a little mantra, like the only way out is through.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard some people refer to it as like bare attention, or, you know, like mindfulness or attentiveness. Some people do it through meditation, but I feel like the way that I've similarly, like, I'm realizing as you say it is like, yeah, like there isn't really any applicable tool that I find for myself that always works outside of like digging in to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And
when you talk about meditation, I'm a terrible meditator.
Isn't like everyone?
I just cannot sit still to, you know, and people have talked about me for most of my entire life, how calm you are, how you're such a calming presence, you're so chill, you know, 'cause all this, well, that's what everyone else gets to see. My mind does not stop.
Yeah.
And I will happily sit over here and create all manner of chaos scenarios for myself, real, imagined, somewhere in the between. But meditation for me has not been a good.
Yeah.
I have not found that to be helpful or even successful.
I have friends who said exactly that, of like sitting still in my thoughts is actually like the antithesis of what I need.
Yeah, you've talked about going to those sensory deprivation chambers. That's my nightmare.
Really?
Like, that is my health.
Yeah. It's so funny. Like, that is the... I mean, there could be a season where I would hate that. There's moments where I'm like, the last thing I want is deprivation. But
yeah.
I don't know. I've found tranquility in those moments for sure. That is so silly. Like, it's so different for all of us.
This is a funny aside. Not related. I'm going to say it anyway. My middle son had to have a dental procedure a few years ago. Maybe 2 years ago. And he was 14 or 15 at the time. Had never had any kind of anesthesia in his entire life for anything, no matter the level of anesthesia. And for 2 or 3 weeks leading up to it, he was just like, so they're going to put an IV in my arm. Then where do I go? I was like, well, you're going to go to sleep. He's like, no, that's not what I've been reading. You don't go to sleep. They put you to sleep. Where do you go while you're asleep? He was just all having an existential crisis about it.
He's like, but where is the realm?
Right. Where's the shadow realm that I'm going to go to? He was talking about how that was his living hell.
That is.
This idea of just going under anesthesia was like too much to bear. Well, and it's like the same kind of drawing the parallel between that and a depression state. It's like sometimes I look at from the outside looking in and I'm like, where did I go? Hmm. Or especially looking back.
Yeah.
You know, because I can point to all the triggers easily. Like, I can tell you the things that will send me down a bad road. Pretty simple. But it's like I don't really recognize myself in those moments. And that can be kind of hard.
Yeah, it's strange. You do feel foreign to yourself.
Yeah.
As much as I hate to hear it goes on in others, it's validating to hear that, like, it's maybe not that foreign of an affair.
I get into those spots and I almost, it's like there's a part of me that almost revels in it.
Yeah.
And that sucks. Like, I see it being destructive. You know, like I said, I can almost see it from third person. But there is a part of me that is almost comfortable there.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think this goes back way back on, you know, from when I was a kid. I don't remember ever feeling any different, you know, all the way back. So I feel like this has probably always been kind of a part of me.
Yeah.
So there is probably a part of me that is comfortable there.
Although I am sad to see depression and heavy sadness present in the lives of those I love, I must admit that it is somewhat validating to know that we're not the only ones feeling this foreign in our own bodies from time to time. Hearing Nathan share openly about turning down plans, losing weight, or even wondering where did I go, is cathartic and in a way warming when I realize I'm not the only one who does similar things. Granted, your sadness may look different to Nathan or I, but hearing someone talk about their patterns can make you find your own cheeky little patterns a little easier, or make them easier to notice. As Nathan sat on my couch sharing his thoughts and occasionally scratching my dog's head, I'd often think to myself, oh my gosh, I do that too. Admittedly, some of that may be that Nathan and I swim through the same colors of sadness, but also these types of symptoms are not all that rare. So then, if we have the same sad symptoms, do we also share the same paths to getting out? After a little bit, I asked Nathan, what is it that pulls him out of the darker times, and if there was anything that he found consistently helpful when climbing out of the molasses?
If I had to point to a catalyst event or some kind of marker that seems to more or less define the moments of uplift, you know, mm-hmm. out of the darkness, is whenever I've got some good friends and they are able to look me in the face and say, you're not okay. Mm. What are we going to do about that? Not, how are you going to fix this? Not, what have you done to fix, but it's, you're not okay, and we're gonna call it out, name it, and then what are we gonna do, what are we gonna do about it? And that has been the thing more than ever, more than anything else. That's been the thing that will lift me up out of that.
We're such community creatures. Mm-hmm. As much as we try to claim introversion or need like solitude, those things are very helpful, but it's like, man, getting yeah. around those you love. I was listening to an Andrew Huberman, just a small portion of his podcast where he talked about being around the people that you're comfortable with and that you love and have affection for just naturally releases happiness and serotonin in the brain and like puts you at ease. It's those moments, like they're hard to get to. It's so funny when I have to drive just a few minutes to get to my mom's house. And when I drive there, like I can feel the anxiety. Like I hate being on the road. I hate being on the highway. Like, what are we going to talk about when I get there? It's like you think about all this stuff.
You and run then
you're
the list. There
and you're just chilling.
Yep.
I remember a few nights ago, I came to your house and I was like, there's going to be a bunch of strangers there. I don't know. Like, what do I talk about? Should I like create a list of potential topics? It's like, heck, maybe no. I'm debuting it too much of my inner monologue. But yeah, once I got there, I finally like took a deep breath and like within 20 minutes I was at ease. Like I forgot that I was sad. I was just there. Yeah. And those are the moments that I have to remind myself in, but it's like I can only remind myself afterwards, which is so funny. It's like such a fog that you find yourself in, which, you know, everybody talks about the gray, the fog, the sludge, like there's reasons why it's that.
I had interaction with a good friend of mine a while back now, but I was feeling the droopies, as we'll call it. And he texted me and he was just like, what's going on with you? Clearly he'd seen something in me. And my response to him, making a joke out of it, was, you know me, just back on my bullshit again. But that was like kind of what it took for that moment to just kind of jar loose, you know, and
back on my bullshit again.
You know,
I feel that.
You know me, man. Just out here.
That's too accurate.
Nonsense.
Yeah, but you're right. It's like, obviously, you don't want to make light of all of it, but sometimes that is the barrier to entry. Like, finally, just like, yeah, I kind of am really sad. Ha ha ha. Let's chat through it.
What an idiot.
Yeah.
But that time, that helped. Another time, it probably wouldn't have.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, it's so situational. It's so circumstantial. And so it's going to be different for everyone. It's going to be different for everyone every time. And what worked last time may be completely stonewalled next time.
Yeah.
And vice versa. What didn't work, what's never worked, might be the only thing you need right now. You know, you said before, you know, the only way out is through. Sometimes that's what it feels like. And sometimes you've just got to go through. And sometimes you do that on purpose. And so I'm a big fan of just putting on some music or putting on a movie, something that I know is going to elicit whatever emotion I'm looking for that I, for some reason, can't get myself to feel. And whether it be sadness, yearning, longing, rage, whatever it may be, and just like diving into that piece of art, piece of media, whatever it is, and just fully feeling that, sometimes for 5 or 10 minutes, sometimes having a big old long ugly cry at the end of whatever movie. Like, it's sometimes you just gotta feel those feelings to get that release, to again just kind of break the cycle of, and for me, what is a lot of freeze, and then I'm able to come back out more than often than not.
Nathan and I continued to talk for a little while about how different he and I experience certain aspects of our emotional flows and how it really is such a variation from person to person. Yet, throughout the conversation, we kept coming back to this theme of having ourselves fully submerged into our emotions, either by choice or circumstance, and finding that to be a catalyst for healing. At times, these moments are created intentionally, and other times they come about much more organically. Nathan hinted at a few of these kinds of memories in his life, and it reminded me of the story I shared in the second episode, where I was lying on the forest floor and similarly letting the ripples of emotion flow over me. In these times where you just lean back and let the river take you, there is a beauty and rejuvenation in that agony. And if the only way out really is through, then these moments might even have some necessity. Now, let's remember the goal I set out with when writing this episode. I wanted to ask, what does it feel like in your brain and body to be gray? But Now I was hearing these other similarities between Nathan and myself. I was also wondering, what does it look like in your life to kick back in the river and let it carry you? What are the moments in your experience where you are fully submerged in your emotions, and what exactly brings that about? If you remember, Nathan mentioned he doesn't like contemplative and silent meditation, so I asked if he would mind sharing what it looks like in his life for this to happen. Now, when I say Nathan is averse to silent meditation, gosh, do I mean it. Because the first memory he shared of what restorative contemplation looks like in his life was from an ambient dark metal concert out in the hills of Tennessee.
Yeah, I'd love to. It's one of my favorite things to talk about.
Yeah.
Is a band called Sun. It's S-U-N-N, zero, parentheses, parentheses, parentheses. So, Seth is trying not to laugh at me right now. It is two guys. They're two middle-aged American dudes at this point, and they write very, very long drone metal music. It's very ambient. It's very slow. It's very deep and low and heavy and very, very loud. Like 20 plus minute long songs that, you know, they'll have one guitar riff that repeats 30 times in 20 minutes, and that's it. They played a show in Pelham, Tennessee at the Caverns inside of a cave. And I went by myself. I'd never gone to a concert before alone, but I know the people around me well enough to know that not everybody wants to go to an ambient drone metal show. Performed by two guys wearing floor-length monk's robes. And so I get there. It's December, so it's cold. And I'm walking down the hill. I'm getting to where the cave is. And I'm standing in line for merch. And I hear the first note come out of the cave, just, you know, 20, 30 feet away. And it is already deafeningly loud. Like, in the merch line, people are shouting at each other. Like, they're going to deafen all of us. It's just the two guys, both playing guitar. And they're tuned down to A, for the musicians. That's a heck of a long way down. And so they're playing essentially bass at this point, but they spent three quarters of the show filling the cave with fog. And so the whole time they're playing, there's just fog machines nonstop. They're just flooding, flooding, flooding. And by three quarters of the way through the show, you couldn't see more than about 10 people on either side of you, on any side of you. And so it almost felt like being in a little room with me and these 30 to 40 people. There was probably 1,500 people at the show, but I couldn't see the back of the room, and I certainly couldn't see the stage. They had one strip of lights that ran pointing upward along the very front edge of the stage, and that was it. That was the only lights. They had no spotlights on them. You could not see them, even when the fog kind of parted. You could only see just glimpses of these guys. So it wasn't really a show. There wasn't really anything to see. Like, for half of it, I just had my eyes closed. At one point, late in the show, I looked around. You know, it's a metal show. You have your typical metal crowd, but none of the typical metal show behavior. Nobody's jumping around, nobody's moshing, nobody's doing anything. People are standing still with their eyes closed, a lot of them, the 30 or 40 people that were in my room with me. And I look back kind of to my left, and on the floor was a guy sitting cross-legged with his eyes closed, just lost in the moment. There was a couple, a young man and a woman, standing on the other side of me, off to my right, he was behind her, and he had his arms around her from behind, and they were just embracing through it all. And it was just such a surreal moment. Because, and while all this peacefulness is going on around me, it is the loudest sound I've ever heard in my whole life. It is so loud. I've got earplugs in and it's still loud. And I'm standing there and I'm just weeping. About 10 minutes to the end of the show, I'm just crying. Because it was just, it was such an overwhelming presence of sound. And the only thing that there was left to do was pray and feel. Because you could feel the sound. And so I stood there and I prayed and I was mad. And I was angry about some things and I yelled at God for a little while. And then once that was done and that was spent, I just stood in the, I almost said stood in the silence, but it was not, it was far from it. But it was a silent moment inside of me where this incredible loud noise is happening. And I was able to just sort of exist with, without expectation. We talked about before, like there was nobody looking at me. There was nobody paying any attention to me. I was just able to be. And then after an hour and 45 minutes, they did not pause. They did not slow down. They did not take a break. They didn't have any stage banter at all. And at an hour and 45 minutes, exactly, the sound stopped. And I felt like I was on a train that had pulled into the station. It was like a physical thing. Like I lurched forward. And I was like, okay. I'm done. And then I got in the car and I drove an hour back home. And I've never experienced anything like that. It was the wildest experience. That was like sort of a non-experience. Like I just went and stood in a cave with 1,000 of my closest friends and listened to essentially the same 5 notes over and over again for an hour and 45 minutes. But it was so unbelievably good. And good for me. It was amazing. On the same token, but a different, very different experience. Well, not all that different. Different circumstance, similar experience. I was in Iceland 3 years ago, 2022. And I went by myself on kind of a whim. There's a theme here, you know, when I go by myself places. But I went by myself. It had been the first time that I'd been back since 2019 after COVID and all that had shut everything down. I had a break between jobs and I called a friend of mine there and I said, hey, unless you tell me otherwise, I'm booking a flight and I'll see you on Friday. Kind of like it was 5 days ahead of time kind of thing. So I go there and no agenda, no real plan, just seeing people I love and seeing places I love. And so I ended up borrowing a car and taking a car up through, it's an area of Iceland called Þingvellir, and it's their like national park kind of area. It's very remote, very out in the middle of nowhere kind of spot. There's one road in, one road out. And I drove up through Þingvellir and it was in March, so it was still firmly winter for them. And I got to a spot where I looked in front of me and I can see landscape for miles and miles and behind me for miles and miles and I don't see any cars. And it was snowing a little bit. My roads were fine, but it was snowing a little bit and I ended up stopping the car in the middle of the road. And I got out and I walked 100 yards away down the road, just on the middle of the street, you know. And I ended up standing in that snow for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and just letting the snow hit the ground and hit me. And being completely and entirely present in that moment and just hearing the nothing that was everywhere. There was some wind, but it was a still day. And hearing individual snowflakes hit the mounds they're on, hearing them bounce off my jacket, you know, knowing that I'm getting soaking wet and I don't even care, and feeling that just incredible peace that came with that. And at the same time, like, sad at, like, and kind of angry at that same peace, because I know that I'm not going to find it in Nashville, and wanting so badly to just sort of, I don't know, inhale this moment, whatever it is, whatever it takes to just get the most out of this experience of being in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Iceland, in the snow, letting it all happen.
It's so hard to walk away from those moments too.
It was really hard to get back in the car.
Yeah. Because you know there's, that's it.
Yeah.
Like, you won't return to that.
I'll never have a moment like that again.
Yeah.
But when you talk about the library of places that I can go back to, where I know there's peace and I know there's safety and all the things that I don't often feel, I can go back to that concert, I can go back to a couple of other concerts, I can go back to that road. I know those moments. I have walked them over and over again. And I probably will keep doing that.
What is it about these non-experiences of being entirely present to hear the nothing that pulls us closer to ourselves? I find them intriguing because they carry a lot of weight and purpose both in the moment of them happening and then later too as a helpful bookmark you can reflect on. For how they feel in the moment, I think Nathan said it best by mentioning how there is a silence created inside of you where you're able to temporarily just be without any expectations. In those silent escapes in time, there is often not a lot of room left but to just exist. Hans Selye, an endocrinologist who studied how stress impacts the body, claimed that most of our tensions and frustrations stem from compulsive needs to act the role of someone we are not. So there is a part of me that wonders if in these quiet moments, maybe we finally take a break and stop acting out the roles and expectations of our daily lives. It may not even be something crazy deep or complex within our psyche that we're acting out. I mean, at risk of putting it too simply, maybe we are acting like someone who has it all together, and admitting things are a bit too much right now could be the first step in accepting some needed help. Or maybe we are acting like a happy or tough person who can't have bad days because it would ruin our brand. Well, maybe shedding an honest tear could let a little pressure off. Like a broken record, I will say, I don't know what it will look like for you. But for myself, these rare and treasured moments break the monotony of life up long enough for me to get my head above water and take a deep breath. And it sounds like for Nathan, they do similar. As it passes from the present into memory, these moments also take on new utility. Nathan eloquently put how as you start to encounter enough of these experiences and accumulate a few of them in your memory, they become a mental library of places you can go back to where you know there is peace and safety. I can say, I have seen this in my own life as well. That they can start to live as these little oases in your brain and body that you can go back to and remind yourself that, okay, maybe it's not misery all the time. These moments when pulled off the shelf of the mental library can become a point of focus in the mayhem that allows you to stay focused in a calming way. So I guess that begs the question, when was the last time you put down all the expectations and presumptions of you to just float in the river a bit? Do you have a mental library of tranquil places you ever revisit? Because wherever you sit on the spectrum, whether it be sensory deprivation chambers or haze-filled drone metal concerts in a cave, I do hope you are finding a way to prioritize yourself and create some little oases where possible. I said it before and I will say it again. You are worth every ounce of effort it takes to get better. and I hope you use every resource you have to take care of you. I like writing episodes like this because an evergreen goal of this podcast is to share the stories of others whom I love and find interesting, and to share them in a way that lets us break away from focusing on ourselves too hard. And hopefully this goes to show that we are not the only ones who feel sad sometimes. So, whether you find yourself in a peak or a valley at this moment, I hope you can find a mental oasis in the library of good memories that you have. And if no memories immediately come to you that you can dip into, then I hope you find the energy to go out and create them. And hey, thanks for listening.